Okay, with the slight nervousness of this being recorded for posterity. Anyway, thank the organizers very much for letting me join this fantastic meeting. So I'm going to talk about some work we have been doing after, of course, a background introduction on low-dimensional superconductivity and various heterostructures formed with strontium titanate. And this has been in collaboration with this gang here. So it's a postdoc and student from our group. These guys weren't around for the picture, but let me say this was also work done by Professor Bok-Gi Kim, who was doing a one-year sabbatic with us in Tokyo. Okay, so first let me start with a background introduction. Almost 50 years ago, superconductivity was discovered in electron-doped strontium titanate. And you might say that this was the original superconducting semiconductor. And I use this terminology for two reasons. One, there's a myriad call for proposals on superconducting semiconductors. But as you probably all know, there's been lots of interesting developments in heavily n-type doped semiconductors. In the last few years, there's been, maybe classic systems, but also diamond, germanium, silicon, silicon carbide. And so there's been lots of interesting findings in, let's say, 5-year span or so. And here's a compilation, roughly, of superconducting transition temperatures as a function of three-dimensional carrier density. But what you find is, first of all, that even these new discoveries, if you find that they're all basically in a very heavily doped regime. And just so you know, they're formed usually by heavy boron ion implantation and some post-annealing or this sort of a game. And so, you know, these are fractions, percents of electrons per unit cell and above. And in that context, if you look at various reports of doped strontium titanate in the literature, it's still quite unique in being in this low density regime. Okay. So it's, as far as I understand, the lowest density known bulk superconductor even today. And as we kind of transition in this region in, you know, what you would call in a textbook going from metallic regime to a semiconductor regime, you might naturally ask whether you can think about using band structure engineering ideas to play with superconducting heterostructures. And so let me first give you a few comments that might be useful for understanding later parts of the talk. It's a classic material that's already been discussed several times this morning. So it's a cubic perovskite system at room temperature, and below 105 Kelvin goes through a tetragonal distortion that's cartooned here. And if you look at band structure calculation, in this particular case, it's a non-relativistic calculation for this cubic symmetry. What you find is that if you blow up where the electrons go at this pocket in gamma point, it looks like it's kind of upside down gallium arsenide, okay? So you have basically heavy and light electron mass bands that are slightly split because of this tetragonal distortion, and a spin orbit split off band with a scale of about 20 millielectron volts. And as you've already heard from Suzanne or Professor Stemmer's presentation, it's readily electron doped and it's relatively high electron mobility for d-electron systems. And another peculiarity that might be in the background of some of the things that Jim just talked about, it's also been quite an intriguing system because it's got a very soft phonon at low temperatures. Okay? So many of you probably know barium titanate or lead titanate or ferroelectrics. So this is a guy that almost wants to become a ferroelectric. And here is old data from Ginch Rani and colleagues at Brookhaven, where if you look at the transverse optical phonon mode that would condense essentially in the ferroelectric phase, this thing is getting extremely soft, about 2 MeV at liquid helium temperatures. And so corresponding to this, you have a dielectric constant that's already big, 300 or so at room temperature, and blows up to something like 20,000 at low temperatures. So with that kind of backdrop, there's been lots of interesting recent developments in looking at superconductivity in the literature. I just picked one of them, following up what Jochen Mannhardt told us this morning about some of the things going on here. 2-3 years ago, he and colleagues in Geneva found that this conducting interface is actually not just a metal, but actually superconducting in its ground state. And in this particular paper, they showed that it nominally seems to scale as a two-dimensional superconductor. So this was quite exciting to us. So I'm going to give you kind of two stories. The one is work that we've been doing, following up on their work, looking at the nature of superconductivity, in particular gate response of this superconductor. And Chris was the driving force behind this work. So now in the specific introduction to this subtopic, a year and a half ago there was a very exciting paper, again from this collaboration between Geneva and Augsburg, where they used a backgate structure to gate the interface superconductor here, and they could map out a phase diagram. In this regime, they had a two-dimensional superconductor, and as they go to negative bias on this gate, okay, that corresponds to depleting electrons in this channel, they could suppress superconductivity all the way down to zero. And as you can see from the scaling line, they were suggesting that this transition temperature scales with an exponent of 2/3, and primarily attributed this to essentially a scaling of the carrier density. That is, you know, as you would naturally expect, by changing this gate, you're changing the 2D density, and that was a relative knob that you were turning in this superconductor insulator transition. And as probably many of you in the audience know, there's been long-standing interest, starting essentially from right after the discovery of high-temperature superconductivity, to think about using field-effect devices to tune interfaces. And it's a lovely idea. You can do a whole series of systematic experiments in one sample. And of course, the disorder potential, the chemical profile is fixed. And so the notion is that you would have a platform where you could just change the carrier density without altering the disorder landscape. Hopefully I can show you there are a few wrinkles to this picture, or refinements that we'd like to discuss here today. So following this work, and after finally getting our fridge to stop leaking, we've been looking at magnetotransport properties in this interface under backgating, so the same geometry that I just showed you. So there are some similarities and differences in our results, and I'd like to highlight what we can learn from both. First, I just show you raw data, and sheet resistance is a function of temperature. And so basically, you have a superconducting transition. And if we go to reverse bias, we go to something that is not superconducting and starts to head towards insulating flow. And as if we go in the accumulating direction, there's some differences in the transition temperature until we get to a regime where down to our lowest measurement temperatures, we're nominally metallic all the way down. Now, if I look at the same samples, one of the nice things in the perpendicular geometry, especially the upper critical field of strontium titanate, is extremely low. So we can be well in the superconducting state and suppress TC and go into the normal state properties. Okay. And so at 100 millikelvin, at this line here, then by applying magnetic field, we're simultaneously measuring rho xy. And here's the plot corresponding in colors to this these figures here. And so what you can see to first approximation is there are systematic changes in slope, as you would expect from changes in carrier density. But I also want to draw your attention to the fact that we're in this reverse bias regime, we're rather linear, actually all the way out to, I think, 14 Tesla or so. As we go into this accumulation regime, we have increasing nonlinearities apparent in the Hall coefficient or Hall resistance. Okay? And I'm going to discuss this later or come back to this point. And essentially, our thinking is in terms of a multi-channel picture for the Hall effect. And for the parameters that we're thinking about, specifically the first time we were playing with this, if you're interested in the details, can be found in this reference here. So I think this is kind of the bottom line message experimentally for this section, which is that at this interface, under a variety of backgate voltages, you can find two features. First, we find that the carrier density is indeed changing as you would expect. So it is electrostatically behaving like a transistor or a depletion mode device. But it's actually a rather modest change. So end to end in the data I just showed you, we're getting, you know, roughly a 50% change in carrier density. So sheet carrier densities here are going from roughly 2 to 1 or something of that order, 10 to the 13th per square centimeter. Now, it's kind of complicated here, but the reason for the complication is we're just trying to visually simply capture the fact that this is getting increasingly nonlinear. So these points are low field data for extracting the density from the Hall coefficient. These are high field data. And you can see, again, in this region, their Hall effect is very, very linear, so these basically fall on top of each other, but it opens up because there's increasing nonlinearities here. Okay, but if I look at this axis here, what we find is the mobility is actually dramatically dropping. So this is a linear scale, this is log scale, and you can see that we're collapsing by an order of magnitude or more in mobility across the same range of gate bias. So basically, mobility is dropping 5 times faster than the change in the 2D, the sheet carrier density. So like most things, you know, some of this has been done before or thought about before in different contexts. And I think perhaps the most analogous issue was mobility modulation first discussed in things like gallium arsenide heterostructures. There's actually an earlier history, I think, even in top and back gated substrate bias silicon MOSFETs. But in any case, what I'm taking here is work from actually colleagues in Tokyo. And what they've done here is made a 2D electron gas and studied the effects of gating it as you would normally think of in a MOSFET, so top gating it as well as back gating it. And maybe this picture captures everything I want to say here, which is that if you change the density electrostatically by gating, actually the details of how you deform the charge distribution are quite different between these two cases. Specifically, what you find here is when you're doing back gating, the way you're depleting carriers is you're raising this potential up on the backside. So you're squishing the electron wave function up harder and harder against the interface. So back then, they already noted that there was quite a different dependence of the mobility as a function of sheet carrier density depending on whether you used a front gate or a back gate. And I just mentioned that at that time in the mid 80s, people were discussing things like velocity modulated transistors. And for those of you who are familiar with high mobility 2DEGs, you know, this heterojunction insulating gate FET that is quite popular to really fine tune carrier density is actually in the same vein of work. So we tried to basically use this as a way to estimate some of the effects we'd find. And you know, while I'm a true believer in interest, and we're very interested in correlation effects, we got to do something. So forgive me for taking just a single particle semiconductor picture, and we're using the measured mobile transport density for our calculations here. Okay. So again, I just repeat the cartoon. What in pictures, what we're thinking about is how does the charge distribution change as we start to deplete by applying a negative backgate bias, and we want to essentially solve the charge distribution for various biases. Okay. So this has been studied from a long, long time ago, and so what we've basically set up is the same calculation, and we're basically making one big simplification. Remember I told you that the dielectric constant is very nonlinear, right? So the differential permittivity is a strong function of electric field. Here we've done kind of the lowest order thing, which is to just treat it in linear order. We capture this nonlinear epsilon self-consistently, but only on average. Okay, so we're keeping a triangular potential type point of view. And so I'm just showing you here first what we do is we solve this self-consistently for zero gate bias. And you can see that in the black curve here. And to leading order as we gate this accumulation or depletion, what you can see here is actually the peak density isn't doing much. The more dramatic effects are actually coming from moving this tail or the width of this charge distribution. And so just as was discussed in gating 2D electron gases in semiconductors, indeed, although the disorder landscape is fixed by the FET, presuming, of course, there's no ionic motion or displacements, the relative strength increases upon depletion, okay? So our perspective is that disorder is actually the dominant tuning parameter in this device. Okay. So if I just go back to our, remind you of the raw data, and then plot this as a phase diagram, what we have here is a phase diagram that looks something like this. We have an insulating state, a superconducting state. This region definitely looks like it's scaling as two dimensions. But we have another region of the phase diagram where we can close this thing off and go to a transition to a metallic state. Again, apparently down to lowest temperatures, which may be, to be conservative, electron temperatures of 50, 60 millikelvin. So this series of data, in some sense, is quite reminiscent to classic work that has been going on for decades in disordered quenched 2D superconducting metal films. Here's data from Alan Goldman's group on quenched amorphous bismuth. And as probably everybody has seen at some point or another, you have a very nice separatrix between an insulator and a superconductor, and the scale of this critical resistance is something like 6 kiloohm, okay? And that, perhaps less convincingly here, but that seems to, again, set the scale for when we're going from a superconductor to an insulator. So starting from early discussions of Maekawa and Fukuyama, and then, of course, many, many people since then, we're thinking of this in terms of basically a disorder-driven transition, and it seems to map very much onto that story. So before I leave this topic, first I want to give a summary and one perhaps important comment. I show you here this data from Jean-Marc Triscone's group and superimpose that R data, okay? So there are some features, as I show, looks quite similar, but some that are different. And one of the points is that our phase diagram looks quite a bit compressed. In fact, we can kind of close this thing all the way off. And yet on a much smaller scale of gate voltage, okay? So that's not actually obvious, right? If this is just electrostatics, you would think that I should be able to scale this effectively one to the other. And as far as we understand, that the essential feature here is that because we have this strongly nonlinear epsilon, you know, things are non-universal. So the absolute magnitude of the carrier density matters as much it is, as it does how much voltage you apply, okay? So namely, let's say I'm sitting here on a particular device. I first self-consistently think about what is the potential profile confining my electrons, and where, what electric field distribution that gives me is going to set kind of self-consistently the scale of that confining potential. So specifically in our case, the zero bias starting carrier density was about 50% lower than I believe what was reported in this data. And so that's, I think, the essential differences in phenomenology between this and there are recent examples from other groups on the archives. Okay, great. So in that context, well, actually, we were starting this other business for a while before that, but I would like to now contrast this to work we've been doing in another way to achieve two-dimensional superconductivity in strontium titanate, and trying to understand if we can get to a different regime from what I just showed you, right? That is something that is approaching the clean limit. And the main guys working on this are these two guys, Kozuka and Minu Kim here. So there was a lovely discussion this morning from Suzanne on issues of growing STO. It's been a bane or a nightmare for almost a decade of our own lives. And let me just tell you something that I think was quite an important breakthrough in our own lab that this guy came up with. So we're using pulse laser deposition, as many people here already have seen. Maybe two important features that are highlighted in yellow here. We're growing extremely hot compared to typical growth temperatures. And we're growing in extremely low oxygen partial pressures, okay? So of course, this induces oxygen vacancies, and then we're post-annealing. Actually, this is one recipe, or sometimes we're post-annealing in situ at a little bit lower temperature. Okay? And this turned out to be a very, very important step, and I'd like to discuss that briefly. So why would you go to such strange and extreme growth conditions? Okay, and this whole game has to do with defect management. Okay. So at the very simplistic level of our understanding anyway, if I think about the point defect of having a titanium vacancy, this has a very high formation energy. So at the first approximation, I don't have to worry about this. Okay. So the main game is that you have strontium vacancies, which are bad because they trap two electrons, they introduce disorder. And they're competing, say, with oxygen concentrations. So you have a Schottky-type defect. And actually, this is bulk from bulk literature. What you can easily imagine from these kind of simple rate equation type of pictures is that if I start with high oxygen partial pressure, I have a low oxygen vacancy concentration. And as I lower the vacuum chamber pressure, I get more and more and more oxygen vacancies. But for a given set, say for a given temperature, correspondingly, I'm going to kick down the strontium vacancy concentration. Okay? So our idea, or Kozuka's idea, was that why don't we use detailed balance to minimize the formation of strontium vacancies and then backfill oxygen. You see, oxygen mobility is very high at relatively low temperatures where nothing else is happening in the cation lattice. So we and many other groups have struggled for a long time. Nobody could really grow high or electronically active low-density strontium titanate at all. And if what you, little you could do was very low mobility. So the game here is to use thermodynamics to try to help minimize the formation of oxygen strontium vacancies. And this we can solve later by post-annealing. So just to summarize how films look like in this growth regime, these are basically Hall mobility data for various concentrations of electron dopants. I should point out that niobium has a few percent solubility limit. So this is lanthanum. The rest of these are niobium. And so we're marching up nicely in mobility. And if I plot that as a function of carrier density, let me make two comparisons. Previously in our group and also throughout the literature, we were always limited in this density range to below 100 centimeters squared per volt second. And secondly, if I take these points, these are these blue dots here, and compare it to kind of a best bulk single crystal data, we're nicely like following on this line. And you just heard from Suzanne, very exciting news. That if I remember the parameter she told me, maybe there's another point here by a different technique. So things are really getting exciting. As far as getting to a very high mobility regime. Now, we worried a little bit because we're growing fairly aggressively, right? We're playing these games and, you know, okay, let me slightly advertise PLD. Of course, there are many issues about the kinetics of growth and point defect formation, but there are many ways you have advantages, I would claim. You know, it depends on the game you want to play. But this strategy here has nothing to do with the kinetics of PLD. One of the reasons we're going so hot is we're just trying to get equilibrium thermodynamics relevant for defect formation at play, okay? And so I don't know anything about this organic precursor type synthesis, but if there's any merit to this, this should be equally applicable to other growth techniques as well. So just to give you an idea, some of the types of things that we've been doing to make sure we know roughly what we're doing here. This is a test structure where we've used a niobium doped substrate and undoped strontium titanate doped. Anyway, by secondary ion mass spectroscopy, you can see that basically it's quantitatively close to what we were thinking it should be. These interfaces are limited by the resolution of the instrument. And basically over quite a few decades, we can get tunable carrier density corresponding to our chemically targeted carrier density. So, So maybe I'll have to accelerate some parts of this, but we've been now taking this structure to imagine something very simple, actually, which will take electron-doped strontium titanate, sandwich it between undoped strontium titanate, and just vary this thickness. And the question is, can we see various dimensional crossovers as this passes relevant scales? So the structure I'm going to focus on mostly here is putting 1% niobium doped strontium titanate embedded in undoped strontium titanate. And the conduction band profile would look something like this. 1%, just to orient you, in the bulk phase diagram of superconducting bulk phase diagram puts us roughly here. And if I cartoon this as just like a triangle or well, then we can pull off numbers, say, for the area function, wave functions that would solve this. So I'm going to spend now most of the remaining time talking about a particular sample that's 5.5 nanometers thick doped layer in this heterostructure. So mobility is pretty good, over 1,000 at this case. Carrier density in this case is upper 10 to the 13th. And you can see a nice superconducting transition temperature here at about 370 millikelvin in this case. So one of the ways we wanted to test the dimensionality of superconductivity is to do transport measurements of the upper critical field as a function of field orientation. So here's the raw data normalized to the normal state value. And this is just as we rotate from out of plane to the in-plane direction. And so if I take just, in this case, I think 50% midpoint TCs, you can see here this upper critical field. It has this very strong cusp. And this has been well analyzed a long time ago from Michael Tinkham. And we can basically see that this is really in a regime where the thickness of the superconductor is far below the coherence length. And similarly, if we look at the temperature dependence of the upper critical field in in-plane and out-of-plane orientations, you can see, again, characteristically of two dimensions, that the in-plane direction has a square root of reduced temperature dependence, not the t-linear one corresponding to the perpendicular direction. And finally, the one useful thing that you can get out of this analysis is you have a direct independent measure of what the superconducting thickness is. And the numbers we get are about 9 nanometers, which are pretty close to that which was grown. And this discrepancy hopefully will become clear in a moment. I'm happy to go back into this, but if you're interested later, we've got to work through this whole 3D to 2D crossover. But I'd like to just focus on the last point that's quite exciting for us. Okay, so the things I just skipped, we're going to show you that we've gone from a 3D superconductor to a 2D superconductor on the length scale of the Ginzburg-Landau coherence length being about 100 nanometers. And one interesting thing that we found as we're going along is that the mobilities are really blowing up as we get thinner and thinner. Now, I'd advertised to you with lots of work, we got to bulk single crystal value, so these are potentially enhancements far beyond a bulk value. And in thinking about this, and the reason we're using the language of delta doping is there were similar findings in delta doping in semiconductors. Here's work from Fred Schubert and gallium arsenide. And the idea is quite simple, which is that if I could really put a dopant plane here, if it's really distributed small on all length scales like the de Broglie length, I'm going to have wave functions where I got lots of tail in the undoped region. So the net scattering cross-section is going to be suppressed and mobility goes up. And this perhaps is what we're seeing here. But what's really cool here is that it's, as far as we know, the only system that gets cleaner and cleaner in the 2D limit, right? Every time I have kind of these bulk metal films and I get it skinnier and skinnier, the relative importance of surface scattering dominates. You look uncomfortable. Oh, okay. So, then what we have found recently is that it is clean enough that we can see quantum oscillations. And this is now the same 5-nanometer sample. It went from a superconductor, turn on a magnetic field, it's suppressed to the normal state, and you see weak wiggles at high magnetic field. If you look at the way with the background subtracted, the Shubnikov-de-Haas oscillation scale with angle, what we can clearly see is it is scaling as two dimensions. Skipping the details, if we try to do kind of standard Shubnikov-de-Haas type of analysis, we're getting an effective mass out of about 1.24 M0 for the quantum oscillations. And if I use some of the transport numbers, essentially the ratio from the BCS coherence length to the mean free path, as far as we know, is the highest it's ever been reported, and it's kind of in between the dirty and clean limits. Okay, the number we're estimating here is about 0.2. Okay. Now, the last point I want to point out to you is that actually, if I take these Shubnikov-DeHaas frequencies, I can convert an area, and I have a huge discrepancy between the SDH density and the Hall density. And the way we can understand that, perhaps, is we've now tried to do a fully partially self-consistent subband calculation for this quantum well. And the bottom line is we find about 9 subbands occupied. The charge density that I said was a little bit wider than we would have expected from the grown thickness we think is just corresponding to this wave function leakage. What we calculated is quite close to the experiment. And if I consider that these are the light effective mass in bulk corresponding closely to what we found experimentally, we suggest that these are the subbands that are contributing to the quantum oscillations. Now, this isn't fully self-consistent before George yells at me. There are all sorts of interesting issues about very local effects in the dielectric response. And it's actually quite interesting, right? Because you're talking about huge electric fields and potential changes on few nanometer scale. And so please take this as a guide to the eye. And since I probably overrun, let me just leave up my final slides and touch on a few things. We are interested in seeing how far we can go towards a clean limit. And I think you saw earlier today from local work in Santa Barbara, there's lots of interesting possibilities to really get closer to the clean limit. We're very interested in making artificial structures where we can tune and engineer interlayer coupling. Right? This is a long-standing issue in layered cuprates and layered organic, quasi-2D organic systems. I think this is a lovely opportunity to approach scientifically. And let me stop there and just say there's lots of interesting issues we're trying to do by gating these delta dope structures to think about things like spin orbit coupling. So with that, let me close and thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much for another beautiful talk, Harold. Questions?
So at your highest fields, I mean, what lambda level, lambda level index are you at?
If I remember correctly, at 14 Tesla in this particular 5-nanometer sample, this was something like nu equals 2.2, something that order.
So you're up, getting up close to the quantum regime. Is that what you're
saying? We're getting close to the quantum regime, but again, if you buy this story, what I just told you, we're only seeing like 10% of the electrons, right? So, nu equals 2.2 would be just for this high mobility electron density we're seeing. So it's a little bit complicated, unfortunately, with these other heavier mass subbands.
I'm sorry, I just to go back to this point. Mm-hmm. The discrepancy between the Shubnikov-DeHaas and the Hall, mm-hmm. is that because you have 9 subbands, so you have 9 little pockets, and if you add them all up, you get back to the correct density? Or even accounting for that, is there
no
still
even
a problem?
Accounting that, I don't have very many. So, okay, let me take that opportunity to add to the talk by explaining this a little bit better. What we have done here is to try to integrate the experimentally found functional form for how epsilon varies as a function of E. And just to show that if I took a linear dielectric, I'm going to be able to do something like a triangular well. If I take this nonlinearity into account, it kind of squares off, right, as you can easily imagine. And if we now then take bulk band values, we don't try to handle any renormalizations. We have 9 subbands, but the point is these, even in bulk, have much higher effective mass. So what I'm saying is that we can only see 3 frequencies, and they could correspond reasonably well to the lightest electron effective mass, which would indicate, omega C tau that we're hitting is only like a little bit over 1, right? 4 or 5, if I remember correctly. And that presumably in this scenario that we are not seeing these heavier mass guys.
Right, but if you were to be able to see them, would they account for the missing density, or is there still a problem?
Well, we can't see them, so we can't.
But
I mean, well, first of all, I warn you, this is an experimentalist trying to calculate something. But no, what I'm saying is we see 10% of the density. I sum up the 3 frequencies we see. It's plausible in this scenario that if this were the right picture, then I should have all the density. And I only pick up these because presumably if I want cleaner and cleaner, I'm going to get more frequencies popping in. That's our picture.
So when you talk about the, or on the part of the talk about the films where you compare your results with the with other group, I forgot the first author there, on the thickness depends, where you're driving the costly starless transition.
Oh, the first part, yes, right. Sorry.
So
maybe this picture?
Yeah, exactly, okay. this figure is nice. Okay. So I know the argument has been made about the costly starless kind of like exponent on how you drive this with the back gating. Can you comment on your exponent, if you can extract anything there, or it's...
Okay, yeah, sure. So basically, we've tried the same types of IV scaling and so forth, and normally we have very similar numbers. The caveat we are concerned about is it's experimentally rather challenging. Namely, say HC1 is only a few Oersted, and so and basically, I can say there's no discrepancy in what we see per se compared to what they're saying. We haven't done a series of job, as you can see, really trying to pull out this exponent as we come in. But as far as kind of how the resistance looks like as a function of temperature, you know, BKT fluctuations or something, or how IV scales, it looks rather similar to what was previously reported. But let me give you one caveat in the interest of full disclosure. If I take a bulk single crystal substrate, it looks like it scales like BKT. So what is the point here? It's kind of our feeling. I don't think we can really say this rigorously. Is that there are lots of density fluctuations in bulk, so it's a broad transition. And there are some cases where our films potentially look sharper than in bulk. So in that kind of milieu, we're a little bit nervous about how much we can say. As you know, in all of these systems, in most transport measurements, you don't ever see this, that discontinuous jump, right? It's always smeared out. The argument is usually by disorder. But then I would argue if you put a dirty 3D superconductor, it's going to look like that as well. And so we want to do a little bit more work before we're really sure what we're talking about as far as transport scaling.
Harold, if you could see the wave functions of these states that you create, mm-hmm. what would you like to know about them?
Oh, anything.
be more specific, please.
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't presume anything about the identity of the questioner, but let me just say, I'm not sure I can quickly find. We buried this guy. Because you may say, why did we bury this guy under 1,000 angstroms? Well, we're not sure. One thing is that one of the underlying things that I didn't really talk about is we want a counterexample where we have a very symmetric well where there should be no Rochebaugh, and think about how the two interact, or the two examples are compared. But another functional issue is that if you take doped strontium titanate, us and other people, or actually other people far before us, have found that there's natural surface states that surface deplete. Okay, and so if I want to go in flat band to the surface and really have a symmetric structure, I need this. Now we've been dreaming, you know, I'm next to Professor Shin, this laser, ARPES with a large penetration depth. We've been dreaming about trying to access spectroscopically or somehow the states. It borderline might be feasible. What we can say from a transport point of view is our mobility is rather stable with a capping layer of down to about 500 angstroms, and then we start to collapse. Okay, so that's painfully thick for a lot of the things you might be interested in. Yeah.
Could I give a theorist answer to Seamus' question?
Okay. Please.
I would like to see, and it relates to what Harold said about delta doping, I would simply like to see how far the electron wave function spreads away from the nominal dopant region where it's supposed to be trapped. Even getting one's hands unambiguously on that, I think, would be great in any of these systems.
If I could tail on to that. One of the things that semiconductor people, Seamus, you probably have seen, they do these cleaves, and then try to do conductivity maps. Even delta doping itself, people have done. So that would be lovely to do. People have done some version of that in conducting tip AFM. My slight concern is the microscopic nature of this surface state isn't well known. And just because I fractured it doesn't necessarily mean I don't have it. So then basically the dopant profile or the conductivity profile you might map might be further pulled down by surface depletion. So there are caveats even with that approach.
I guess Suzanne actually perhaps was also going to make a comment. I guess in this particular case, Andy, you were not really interested so much in the wave function. That would be very nice, but in the charge density. Mm-hmm. So it's a simpler thing to calculate, or a simpler thing to measure, perhaps, than the wave function itself.
That would be more interesting. That was my point. No, I said wave function advisedly. Mm-hmm. Because you want to know how far the charge density is. No, it has to
be. As Chandra says, there are various other techniques that measure the charge, that give some information about the charge density. For example, the TEMELs and so on. The wave function in principle contains more information than the charge density. You would love to be able to see all kinds of things about it if you could get your hands on it, orbital character and all this stuff.
If I could, one comment back with that. Two things. We're in a density so low, TEM can't see anything. The second comment would be, this is kind of the same type of subband calculation we did with one band, just to illustrate the issue. Let's take the linear dielectric, lattice dielectric constant in the zero field limit, this huge number. And if we do this self-consistently, we get 22, and we have a bazillion subbands, and the charge density is very broad. We have taken kind of Q equals zero estimate experimentally of this, and you can see this same thing now with a nonlinear epsilon squeezes it way down. So we've lost an order of magnitude. But again, this is a very dicey game. So what we would love to do is get people more serious about these sorts of calculations. Because what I can say is we're starting to generate numbers like Shumnikov to Haas frequencies and stuff. It would be lovely. Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with how things vary with strontium doping in lanthanum titanate.
Okay.
But I do remember that somewhere there is a Mott transition to metal, Mott transition from a Mott insulator to a metal.
Mm-hmm.
So my question really is, do you observe any, has there been investigations carried out about surface states in the regime where one of the insulator is an ordinary insulator like strontium titanate, and the other is a Mott insulator, and then crossing over to when both are ordinary insulators?
I see.
Is there a significant difference? This thing arises because the compressibility of a Mott insulator is a very peculiar thing.
Yeah.
And surface properties depend upon screening or compressibility on either
yes,
side.
Yes. First, I should clarify, that's a very good point and a long-standing interest of ours. All of the things, the second half, this delta doping, we're really in the low-density regime. So we're nowhere close to the bulk. At any point, we're not anywhere close to the bulk Mott transition. That I should clarify. And the second thing is that I think there's more question, as was already alluded to this morning, of what is the total charge density and what is the mobile density, say, in lanthanum aluminate strontium titanate. And that might be more related to your question. At least speaking for myself, I don't think we have enough of a handle. Spectroscopy is starting to give us different numbers, quite different from the transport. And whether that we're just seeing the tail of the beast by transport, would be necessary to know more seriously to answer your question. But I think that's a very interesting underlying issue. You're dissatisfied. I can't tell you more precise things at this point. Yeah.
So can you see something about this Paling symmetry or mechanism? The interface is the same as the bulk?
As far as I understand, that has a long and painful history. This is recorded, so I should be a little bit careful. So it's an interesting system because this was nominally it was nominally theoretically predicted. I think in the early 60s, Marvin Cohen was thinking about an inter-pocket pairing mechanism. And so he was hunting around, I think, anything like germanium, whatever. And so that, as far as I understand the history, motivated this. After better bulk Shubnikov to Haas and some photo emission was done, the original picture was three pockets, 100, 110, along the high symmetry directions. That I don't think is correct, and now it's converged to be all at the gamma point, so that's probably less relevant. There have been hints, a lot of work over several decades in IBM Rusticon, that indicated that soft phonon might be relevant as far as a pairing mechanism. There was one or two tunneling experiments, but at least for my outsider's understanding, in some sense of that bulk literature, I don't think it's clearly resolved. I don't think there is a, you know, clear consensus. But presumably it's some phonon, S wave, that kind of thing. But there are a lot of details that are peculiar. Yeah. Well, if we don't know what the bulk is doing, then it's harder to say something about the interface. As far as I know, that there is nobody has done any phase-sensitive experiments yet in these sorts of things. Actually, I am reminded, Jochen Mannhardt behind you, perhaps motivated by this, had looked at bicrystal junctions. And essentially what I don't know if you guys checked the superconducting state, but what I remember reading in your paper was that it strongly depletes, so you can't really make a weak link, right? Okay. So no phase-sensitive measurements yet, but I don't think they're far away, actually.
Okay, it's getting close to us, and I can see no further. Huh? I think it might be worth just summing up with a couple of words, though, in the sense that it's natural that, you know, we've heard some great talks this morning, it's natural that when spending it together, you concentrate on detail. That's as it should be. But I regard myself as something of an outsider to the thin film field. Seems to me, though, that we're seeing advances now that are both rapid and impressive in this field. You know, the oxide heterostructure, our developments. Pardon?
You want your view graph on?
No, it's okay. No.
Oh, okay.
Just as a summary, the developments we're hearing about, and there'll be another session later on in the week with other speakers, but the sum total of what's going on really is beginning to move pretty fast, and that I would guess that people from outside our field have no idea really about how fast things are moving in this particular subfield, and that's quite exciting for the future. I don't know if anybody else would like to come and give some further comments on that. Maybe Andy Millis has never lost for a word.
I see, now this is getting your revenge for my asking you to be the session chair. Is that... No, I don't want to keep everybody from lunch, so I will say three brief things. and then it'll be 2 o'clock and it'll be time to start the next session. No, first, I think that the issue that was that Chandra raised, and more generally the one that Jochen raised, is important for the whole theoretical community, and that is that once one is talking about strongly correlated materials, in particular ones which are near Mott transitions, all of one's qualitative ideas about how electron gases should behave in the presence of external potentials may require revision. As Chandra said, funny things happen to the compressibility, funny things happen to the magnetic order, you get other states. For all of these reasons, combined with the short length scales that we've seen in all of these things, I think that all of our basic concepts somehow have to be rethought. Also, coming from the correlated electron side, let's say, the field has focused, in my mind, very largely on local physics driven by local interactions, but of course, in semiconductor heterostructures, it's the long-range Coulomb interaction and the self-consistent screening, which is somehow crucial. And marrying those two things have not yet been properly married yet, in my as far as I can understand. Then, just as a statement for experimentalists, this was also implicit in what Chandra said, so I think I'm just going to give the microphone to him after this. One of the things that we all want to see are densities which are very close to one per site. So a question I would ask for the experimentalists is, how close can we get to that one, or an integer number per site? Because that's where all the intrinsically strong correlation phenomena really happen. So with that.
With that, I think we do close the session. Could I thank all four speakers once again for their excellent talks.